Hello, everyone. I'm Kevin Gastola, the managing editor for Shadowproof.com, and I'm very pleased to be joined by Brad Schreiber, who is the author of Music is Power, Popular Songs, Social Justice, and the Will to Change. Thanks for joining, Brad.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Nice to talk with you.
Yeah, and this book is, just to give my quick read on it, you have some specific cases that you go into, which we're going to talk about, particular musicians that you cover. It hits on several musicians who people know very well as musicians who recorded music that had messages or spoke to the political or social moments that they were going through. And we're going to get into each of those cases. But before we really dig into any individual artist, I wanted to give you the opportunity to describe how you arrived at doing this project, which you're chronicling a history that for the most part covers late 1940s, early 1950s music on through to the modern era up through the 2010s, and looking at the evolution of the way music has been used to inspire and speak to political moments.
Well, it's true, Kevin, that this book has a large wingspan, if you will. It actually starts with the Union songs in the 1900s and 1910s, the first chapter, including Joe Hill, and then we go on to, you know, Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger. And the last chapter is Green Day and the Dixie Chicks, but there's an epilogue in which I talk about some of the musical artists today who are pushing back against Trump and issues about global warming and so forth. It all came about probably because of the last two books I wrote. It's a mixture of the two. 2010, I wrote a book called Becoming Jimi Hendrix, and that was an early history of Jimi, written from the research of Hendrix historian Steve Roby. And in 2016, I wrote a book that had always been close to my heart, and it was called Revolution's End, and it was the hidden history of the kidnapping of Patty Hearst by the Symbionese Liberation Army in the 70s, in which I explained to the reader that Patty Hearst was a sideshow and that the creation of this supposed left-wing group was engendered by Ronald Reagan, the prisons, and the CIA. It goes into Donald DeFries' background as an informer at the LAPD, having drugs used upon him at Vacaville, and then being given a get-out-of-jail-free card in order to create the SLA, which behaved irrationally and undercut the Black Panthers and the New Left in the Bay Area in the 70s. So you put all that together, you get music and you get politics, and you get music as power.
Yeah, and so let's get into, and you're right, you do have this wonderful chapter where you dig into what happened with Joe Hill. And you know, for anyone who gets the book, which I encourage people to read the book, absolutely, it's a really great way of entering. And it's not maybe what you expect, because I think a lot of people might start their protest music history, and you talk about Woody Guthrie, but you might solely focus on Woody Guthrie, and you might even be so naive to just start with Bob Dylan. If you think about the way that people would get to and address protest or political music today. So, and before we get rolling, I do want to ask you, just because I don't think there's really a wrong answer. Any way you do it, as long as you justify it, I think is good. In the work that I do covering music, I do outright call it protest music, just as a really easy way to tangibly get people to understand what we're talking about. But I think I understand the baggage that comes along with it. And a lot of artists don't really want to be seen as protest musicians or protest singers because they feel like they're marginalizing their music. Do you have any thoughts you wanted to express on that before we get rolling on the specific artists?
Yeah, I appreciate that very much, Kevin. And I appreciate your work, which I've listened to and read. And a lot of the people who interview me about Music is Power come from the music background and not the strong political research background. So I'm kind of balanced in both of those areas, obviously from, you know, Revolution's End and other stuff I've done. I understand what you're saying about the term protest music. The reason that I shy away from it is the reason I shy away from using terms like conspiracy theory, because linguistics are very powerful. And you can use them to basically undercut someone's rational argument. Well, that's just a conspiracy theory. Well, no, here's the proof. Here's the documents. It's not a theory. Protest music sounds like it's only the 60s. And that was my concern that, as you say, people would say, a book about music that protests, that would be Bob Dylan and Joan Baez, I guess. And I'm trying to suggest that there's a continuum even up to today. And that's why I prefer to call it socially conscious music or socio-political music or anything like that. But as long as we have this understanding that it isn't confined to the 60s, there's nothing wrong with saying protest music either.
All right. So I wanted to, for the first case that we're going to talk about or the first example, really get into what the dynamic was like for musicians after the September 11th attacks and then ahead of the Iraq War. If, as you document in the book or go back to, we have Clear Channel that's involved and they're taking particular songs and they're saying perhaps these particular songs should not air. And then you have the pressure that the Dixie Chicks come under to not make and sing about certain topics because of the march to the to invade Iraq.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you start there because it's fairly recent. And it goes to my previous point to a certain degree about language, linguistics, controlling. There's a guy named George Lakoff out of UC Berkeley who talks about framing arguments with language, that if you frame the nature of the discussion and you get there first, the people on the other side now have to respond to your manipulation linguistically. They don't have an opportunity to make a rational plea because they're being controlled by the ground rules, so to speak, that you've set. And Clear Channel Communications after 9/11 had about 110 million listeners nationally, Kevin. And it was utterly Orwellian, as anybody who remembers that time will agree, in which Clear Channel started saying, these are the songs that we do not suggest our stations play. Their concerns were rather not only all-encompassing, but at times absurd. I understand the raw wound in America, you know, after the attacks of 9/11. But to say that you can't play Peter, Paul, and Mary's Leaving on a Jet Plane because no one wants to think about planes, because planes were used as weapons, is crazy. And the deeper issue is something that Barbara Koppel, who, by the way, did the Dixie Chicks documentary, Shut Up and Sing, communicated with me. And she's utterly brilliant. I mean, she's won 2 Oscars, but the conciseness of her language and her thought just stunned me when we did our interview, because she explained how corporations, not just governments, but now corporations have social control over people if they have enough of a market share. And that's exactly what happened with Clear Channel. And now, as iHeartMedia, they've got, you know, 245 million listeners. So not only did they do to the Dixie Chicks what they did to, you know, the nation after 9/11, But we still have to be cognizant of integration, vertical integration in the corporate world, and the fact that the more that goes on, the less freedom of speech we're going to have. And it's heartbreaking in Barbara Koppel's documentary, Shut Up and Sing, when you see Natalie Maines having a death threat against her in Dallas, Dallas of all places. I don't even need to refer to the assassination attempt that was successful in Dallas in 1963 for that connection to be made. And in some ways, the breakup of the Dixie Chicks, even though they had a successful follow-up album, was due to their faith in the country music establishment, in the radio stations that played country music, and their fans betraying them and saying, you don't have freedom of speech to say in London just before the incursion, the illegal incursion into Iraq, hey, y'all, we just want you to know that we're ashamed that the president of the United States is from Texas. Of course, the people in the UK, Kevin, thought nothing of it because 90% of them were against the war in Iraq. And, of course, Tony Blair completely ignored the will of the people. Well, over here, consent had been, you know, manufactured, so to speak, with apologies to Noam Chomsky. And people were rip-roaring, ready to go and attack Saddam Hussein. So just, not even in song, but just in an interview, the Dixie Chicks were condemned by the establishment. And that is chilling to think about.
It does, however, connect to another aspect from your book that I want to discuss with you. And you could talk more generally about the artist if you want. I mean, it'd be hard to say that most people don't find something really genuinely wonderful about the music of Marvin Gaye. But I wanted to talk to you about the kinds of pressures that he faced as an artist, as somebody who was working for Motown. And, there's not a lot of a connection, but in pivoting from what we're saying here about Clear Channel and everything, you have a Motown corporation that put together an assembly line for artists. And I recommend for people who are listening to our interview that they catch the Showtime documentary Hitsville that was released last year. And I just have a quote from Barry as we get into this part of our conversation, where sure. He talks about how he basically only gave his artists freedom, but within a restriction. He restricted the kinds of he knew he was doing this very consciously because there was a brand that had to be protected. There was a Motown brand. And he admits in this documentary that he was not always right. And that, in fact, Marvin Gaye came to him and threw it in his face when he wanted to go make What's Going On. He knew very well that he was in the wrong for telling Marvin Gaye no initially. And he says in retrospect that I now feel the idea of reflecting the world was not a bad idea at all. And it was something that Marvin Gaye, as well as Stevie Wonder, was trying to impress upon him during the late 1960s and the early 1970s, and particularly with the Vietnam War. So I'll let you go ahead and talk about Marvin Gaye.
And Berry Gordy as well, Kevin, yes. First of all, that is a terrific documentary. I've seen it. Secondly, there's an incredible irony in Berry Gordy and how he ran Motown, because it was both positive and negative. It's almost amusing to think that Berry Gordy, formerly working in an automotive plant on an assembly line, applied the same business tactics to a record label. What's amusing to me is how he had performers seen through a quality control department. They told them how to dress. They worked with them on makeup and dance moves and so forth and so on. Now, on one hand, this is what made his acts so sterling. But the flip side is what happened with Marvin Gaye, which is saying, if you record for my label, you do the music, that my songwriters and my producers and my arrangers provide you. You do not have the choice on your own. And of course, Marvin Gaye became very conscious of what was going on in the Vietnam War because he knew people who came back who had friends who were killed or injured. This happened with other Motown acts as well, by the way. So when he went to Berry Gordy and said, I want to do What's Going On, I feel compelled to talk about the changes in society, Gordy's reaction was, oh, that's political stuff, and that's not going to work. And such was the commitment of Marvin Gaye that he threatened Gordy with leaving the label. He said, I'm going to do this either for you or somebody else, but I'm committed to do this. And what's really astonishing and would certainly never happen in the corporate culture of 2020, Kevin, is there was a sales guy and another exec who behind Berry Gordy's back said, okay, well, just let's record What's Going On and press 100,000 of them and throw it out there without Gordy's okay and see how it does. Well, it did fantastically. And then they produced another 100,000. Then Gordy found out that the song was being released without his okay. And he confronted Marvin Gaye and said, you didn't have the right to do this, but since it did okay, I will grant you the right to do an album, but I'll give you 30 days to record it. Can you imagine? 30 days to do an entire album, write the songs, record it, mix it. And Marvin Gaye astonishingly created that suite of music in 10 12-hour days. So Berry Gordy, like a lot of people in Motown, like Norman Whitfield, the producer, said, okay, let's do socially conscious soul or socially conscious R&B, whatever you want to call it, Kevin, but let's do it only because I now see that it makes money. They had absolutely no commitment socially.
And it's worth noting that last year, for the first time, it was officially released his follow-up, You're the Man from 1972, which had sat on a shelf for decades because, and the quote that was shared in the media widely was that it would spark a backlash from Motown's conservative fan base, end quote.
Well, this is also something I try and make note of occasionally when it's appropriate in Music is Power, which is, it's not always a gamble financially to do political music. Sometimes the times require it. And guessing that we're both sort of politically in the same area, when you have the worst president of the United States who's lost an election by 3 million votes, and there's an incursion on all kinds of rights, you really do look to the artistic sector to push back, as well as, you know, other sectors to protest. But it is almost expected that a response from artists during dangerous and difficult times is required to some degree. And I think we're seeing that now, not only in music, but I see it in the plays I see here in Los Angeles. I see it in films. And it's absolutely appropriate for our times.